today's News Talk Radio, TNT, with Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast.
A chapter in our book, it's taking a leaf from the play in 1953 play called Biedermann and the Arsonist. And it's about just this, that there's an arsonist who's afoot in this town. He's burning everything down, but it's so obvious. He's out in the open. He looks very, there are two of them. They look very normal. They're sort of charming. They're sort of funny. So even though everyone knows that there are arsonists afoot, they still manage to do this. And there's some psychology that seems to affect all of us. If it's out in the open, it's like people don't see it. It's hiding in plain sight. I think people maybe assume that an elaborate conspiracy is clandestine. It would be.
No, the most dangerous ones are hiding in plain view, and that's why they do it.
Yeah, that's it.
And so that's behavioral psychology, which we know they had Yale and Harvard and Princeton and a bunch of other psychology departments test before COVID and after how to make the public shut up, how to make them stay in place, how to make them take shots. So this has all been war game.
And how to harness, manipulate, and use social media to drive this campaign of mass vaccination with no attention to safety or efficacy.
We're going to break. What are we going to cover when we come back? Because that was already riveting information.
Propaganda. I think the public needs to understand just how much the public mind is being shaped by propaganda. I think.
I totally agree, because what you said earlier is so profound. That when they hide it in plain view, we kind of buy into it because it couldn't be real. It doesn't look scary. It's a smiling guy, you know, on TV. But when you pull back, people are caught in it. Only by becoming aware of that can you shift out of it.
Correct.
Wow. Okay, we're going to break. Courage to Face COVID. The website's CourageToFaceCOVID.com. Get the book now, folks. They're not advertising with me. I want to get this book out. I'm going to buy a bunch of the book. I'm going to buy like 10,000 of them today. But everybody needs to get this book. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You're going to buy 10,000 of them? Come on, Alex. You don't need 10,000. Propaganda. Oh, yes. Propaganda and how it operates. Those who are victims of it don't see it. What they believe are facts. They don't understand that they are being targeted and led to believe certain things in certain ways, and that fear and isolation play a dramatic role. Mass formation hypnosis led down wandering rabbit holes in plain sight. As they said, in plain sight. I attempted to negotiate terms of psychology with a loved one recently who believes everything CNN and the like tells them. I attempted to find solid ground from which we could see each other. I said, the real difference is those who believe what the mainstream media says as a fact, with no spin or agenda behind it, and those that simply don't. I was attempting solidarity from opposite spectrums, but they disagreed. They said they were operating from facts, oblivious to where those facts came from. Those that believe they have the facts versus those that see obvious networks of lies and manipulation in campaigns to silence nuanced debate, as in the very least a ticker tape parade of bright red flags that something is off, something is way off, or at worst, a nefarious plan to confiscate all of humanity's basic civil liberties and God-given rights, to enforce satanic levels of control, to bully God out of the pulpit and usurp more power for the so-called elite, I suppose to test the theory that there can be no acquisition of power and control enough to fill the God-sized hole. There can never be enough. That hole is a black hole, which won't be satisfied even if the whole universe were to fall in. That's why those of us tuned into the truth of what's happening, the hidden and plain sight truth of it, are mesmerized that people will not only give up their rights, but campaign to do exactly that and more. Campaign against their own freedom for an illusion of safety that doesn't exist. People are far more afraid of the great beyond than we could have garnered, that we could have ever imagined. They will trade their souls for another minute outside of oblivion, even when oblivion is inevitable. We'll be right back with TNT Radio.
We're not exactly mind readers, but
they say what I'm thinking.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Michael Balzer is a public policy analyst and a professor. microfinance at Stockton University. Oh, Michael Balzer, PhD, is a public analyst, and he's featured columns in Newsmax, The Hill, The Western Journal, and townhall.com. Let's talk inflation and propaganda with Michael Balzer right now. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. Boy, I'd love to get a copy of that jingle.
Well, you'll have to pay $1 million for that, Michael.
Oh.
Just $1 million. But you can afford it because, you know, you're a superstar writer. I was just checking out your, and I'm kidding, of course, you can get it. You can get that. And, you know, I can even put a drum beat to it or something. But I was reading your recent Newsmax article about inflation pauses, but will get even hotter this summer. I like that. You did the spin on the weather with it. I could go into reading sections of it, or we could just talk about it. Tell us what's going on with inflation and what in God's name we can do about it.
excuse me. The first part's a little easier. What we can do about it's a little tougher, but so let's take a look at the let's take a look at the inflation problem. How bad is it? So the last numbers we have are from April, and on an annual basis, that is over the past 12 months, inflation's running about 8.5%. That's the highest we've had really since the early 1980s, about 40 years. What's causing the inflation? So the inflation problem started early last year when the Federal Reserve should have taken some action, but they didn't. It means they have to take very drastic action now and going forward. So what's causing the inflation problem? The Biden administration and the Federal Reserve will say that inflation has been caused by supply chain disruptions. And as soon as those supply chain disruptions go away, the inflation will go away. Now, I disagree with that. And why? Because as of last July, the economy was producing at a rate that was equal to the production rate before the pandemic. Right now, we're producing at a rate about 2% higher than before the pandemic. So in total, we don't have a supply issue because we're producing more now than we did prior to the pandemic. However, there are certain markets that do have supply issues. Computer chips, I saw a study that said in 2021, demand for computer chips was up about 17%. And because some factories shut down, supply was down by 10%. So we had a chip shortage, and that showed up higher prices for some computer goods and higher prices for cars. We also have a bit of a shortage with products that we import from China because the ships can't be unloaded fast enough. So there are some issues with the supply chain for some specific markets, but overall, this is not a supply chain issue. So what's causing the inflation? In my view, there are four reasons why we have inflation today and why it's going to get worse going into the summer. Two of the reasons are on the cost side, and two of the reasons which have more impact are on the excess demand side. So what are the four reasons? Number one, the Biden administration would like to see Americans use less fossil fuel and more alternative energy sources. So as a result, from day one, President Biden got into office, took action to reduce the supply of fossil fuels. How did he do that? He canceled the Keystone Pipeline, prohibited drilling on federal lands, although I just heard today he may reverse that. But he prohibited drilling on federal lands. You can't drill on the Anwar off the coast of Alaska. He made regulations more difficult. And he said to banks, listen, I'd be very careful about lending to anybody in the oil industry because it doesn't have a future. All of those actions restricted the supply of gasoline. And when demand is growing, because the economy is recovering from recession, high demand, low supply, you get higher prices. So energy prices are going up. And I think gasoline hit another record price today, I think for about the eighth day in a row. Now, that means not only do we pay more for gasoline and heating oil, but it also means that manufacturers are going to have to pay more for energy, and they're going to have to recover that cost. So that'll put upward pressure on prices. Even retailers, they get their goods shipped in primarily by truck. You look at the price of gas of diesel fuel today, you see how high it is. So reason number one why we have inflation is rising energy prices, brought about almost entirely by Biden administration policies. Reason number two, the federal government has been paying people not to work. Why do I say that? Well, somebody got unemployed during the pandemic. They got unemployment compensation from their state. Almost all states lengthened the amount of time you can get that. On top of that, the federal government added $600 a week on top of what you were getting for unemployment compensation. When that ran out, they changed it to only $300 a week. And in addition, the federal government handed out stimulus money in the last 2 years to everybody, whether you were negatively impacted by the virus or not. So a lot of people say, listen, I have a lot of money that the federal government gave to me. And you know what? I haven't paid rent on my apartment for 2 years, and there was a moratorium, so I couldn't get kicked out. Mostly the younger people I talk to say, I'm going to try to stretch this out as long as I can. I get all this money and I don't have to do anything. Well, business needs to attract people back to the workforce. So what do? They start raising wages, figure we'll raise them high enough that will bring people back into the workforce. They might say, well, that's a good thing. Wages are higher, people are making more money, and it is good from that aspect. However, business paying more for labor increases their labor cost, which again puts upward pressure on prices. So energy prices and wage inflation on the cost side. Most of the inflation is caused by excess demand. Why do we have so much excess demand? Federal government has deficit spent nearly $6 trillion in the last two fiscal years. On a $22, $23 trillion economy, that will lead to pure inflation. And I'm not talking about reducing spending. In fact, President Biden wants to add more. So reason number three, excess demand from government deficit spending. The primary culprit for the inflation problem is what I refer to as the shockingly irresponsible behavior by the Federal Reserve and keeping an expansionary monetary policy, which means they were pumping up the money supply through their bond buying program, and they kept interest rates near zero. As a result of that, some people said, you know, I wasn't going to buy a new house this year, but I can get a 2.5% mortgage, and the federal government gave me enough money for a down payment. Hundreds of thousands of people decided to buy houses. We didn't have enough houses. That excess demand drove prices up. So the four reasons we have inflation: energy inflation, wage inflation, excess government spending, and the shockingly irresponsible policy, monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. So all of that has led to about an 8.5% inflation rate. And I don't see the inflation rate going down. Now, why not? A couple things I look at. The producer price index, which is inflation at the manufacturer's level, is now running at 11%. Eventually, business is going to have to pass that along or they're not going to be profitable. That's why Target and Walmart just reported good sales, but their profits sank. Why? Cost of goods to them, manufacturing costs, and labor costs are going up. They can't pass it all along to price increases with price increases, and that's why their profitability was so poor. I think inflation is going to get worse going into the summer, and what you alluded to when we started. Now, why do I say that? We're about to have a very severe food inflation problem, brought about by a couple of things. One, the farmers are paying more for, because much of this is petroleum-based, the farmers are paying more for fertilizer, they're paying more for labor, and they're paying much more for diesel fuel to operate their equipment. Well, as their costs go up, again, if they're going to be in business, they have to make a profit, that's going to drive prices up. In the worldwide market, it'll be even worse. because Russia and Ukraine produce about 25% of the world's wheat supply and some other grains. Most of that export has been stopped. That will continue. That will lead to a food shortage worldwide. And I'm afraid when food prices go up, Americans will complain about it, but they'll still buy it. They have the money to pay for it. Third world countries don't have the money to pay for it. I hope it doesn't get to this, but you could see some of the poor, less than developed nations running out of food. And of course, that gets into some very difficult situations. So inflation is getting worse in the summer. Now, let me add one other point to that. The Federal Reserve, as I mentioned, waited way too long to react to this. They should have started reacting to this last March. Now, why do I say that? The Consumer Price Index is the best measure of inflation at the consumer level. Typically goes up about 0.2% a month. So if it does that for 12 months, you have about a 2.5% annual inflation rate, which is about what we had prior to the pandemic. Starting last
healthy.
January.
That 2% is healthy. That's fine, right?
It's but very healthy. As a matter of fact, last year was 1.8%, I think, was even less than the 2%. So what started to happen? Last January, consumer prices went up 0.3%. February, they went up 0.4%. March, they went up 0.6%. In April, they went up 0.8%. Clearly, there's an inflationary pressures are building. The Federal Reserve should have started to gradually nudge interest rates up. Had they done that, the inflation rate, in my opinion, would be about a half of what it is today. But they didn't start raising rates until March of 2022. Now inflation is out of hand. What they're going to have to do is start raising interest rates very aggressively. I expect at least a half a point increase in June, a half to 0.75% in July, and 2 or 3 more before the end of the year. Now, the danger with that, by raising them so fast to take out excess demand in the economy to bring down inflation, but by doing it too fast, they might take too much demand out of the economy, and you'll start to see the economy perhaps go into recession. The first quarter of this year, we did have a negative GDP growth. Most economists are forecasting positive in the second quarter. But by the end of the year, we could see the economy stagnate and inflation still here. That leads to a problem we call stagflation, stagnant economy with inflation, stagflation. And we really haven't seen that since the late 70s into 1980. So I'm not real, and I'm usually very optimistic about things, but I'm not very optimistic about what's going to happen to the inflation and what's going to happen to economic growth the rest of this year.
Oh, great. And you're usually optimistic because you just, you
know,
that forecast was anything but. Now, you said they didn't react fast enough, but I mean, couldn't anybody see that these policies would lead to the results you're speaking of? I mean, it seems sort of obvious that this would happen, you know, with the policies they're implementing. So my question, I guess, is this on purpose?
It's a little hard for me to tell that. You can certainly draw that conclusion.
You're not nuts to consider that, am I right? I mean, it's like you know, because a lot of people,
certainly a lot of people
would go like, "Oh, you're a conspiracy wacko if you think this is purposeful to, like, you know, starve out the population basically to make them easier to control." But we just went through 2-3 years of, you know, our civil liberties being attacked left and right for our air quotes, you know, safety. And then now this, and then Bill Gates buying up all the farmland, and you see food processing plants, you know, 8 of them catch on fire in a week and 2 of them get hit by a plane, and on and on it goes, everything you just illustrated. And it's like, you're not nuts to go like, are these guys doing this on purpose? Like, because this is insane. It's like, listen, I want you to comment on that. Think about that. We got to go to a quick break, and then I want to get you to riff on what I just said. We'll be right back on TNT Radio with
you. Should hear what George Eliason is talking about.
What would have happened in Donbass if Russia hesitated or waited a few days longer to start the military action?
We would not have an opportunity to talk right now. And for that moment, there would be many people would die. They would be killed by Ukrainian army.
Now, if Russia had to respond to that kind of attack instead of stopping it ahead of time, what would have been the outcome for Donbas?
So now what we see now is really the answer of Russia to what Ukraine had been done for 8 years. As we always say, Ukraine unleashed the war and was using the banned means and methods of warfare.
Aggression
towards their own people.
George Eliason on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on the 21st of May.
The government's response to COVID-19 has been a sledgehammer approach, which has not factored in the consequences of placing human life as we know it in lockdown. The government is simply out of touch with the needs of Australians. Purely looking at the reduction of case numbers has decimated our way of life, and it is the goal of the Liberal Democrats to return Australia into a sensible, rational, and free country. Hi, I'm Crystal Mitchell, your Senate candidate for the Liberal Democrats in Victoria, and I've been fighting the lockdowns and the state emergency legislation since I spoke out against the disproportionate responses as a Victorian police officer. I'm here to tell you that your life, family, and work are not to be flicked on and off based on the whims of the government. In this video, I want to talk to you about the first policy in the Liberal Democrats' Freedom Manifesto, freedom from COVID alarmism. The Liberal Democrats believe that the Australian people are smart enough to make their own health decisions. The Freedom from COVID Alarmism policy will make several immediate changes. These include opening the schools. Closing schools decreased the severe COVID risk on children from 0 to 0. Not only that, 2 years of our children's education was ruined. Ending the lockdowns. We've been fighting these lockdowns since day one, and if we're elected, there will be no more lockdowns ever again. Legalising peaceful protests. Protesting is a human right. We should never be punishing people for standing up for what they believe in at a peaceful assembly. Protesting is a part of our democracy, and it should be protected at all costs. Making vaccines available, voluntary, but not mandatory. With rapid antigen tests available, it doesn't make any sense that every person, regardless of their health status, should be jabbed. Ending the mask mandate. Masks should be voluntary. It is only right that the individual chooses how they manage their health and that we do not use coercion to force people into a way of compliance with health orders. Allowing Australians to get home from abroad. Removing the border closures and travel restrictions. It's not okay that Scott Morrison took a private jet to cross a state border to spend Father's Day with his kids while everyday Aussies were not allowed to see each other. We want to remove contact tracing and QR codes, remove social distancing, remove mandatory self-isolation, and end all emergency powers. What will this policy mean for you in the long term? It will mean that you will have certainty that your business will not be arbitrarily closed or have crippling restrictions. It will mean you can plan your dream wedding without worry. It means that you can see your family and friends who live overseas or in another state. It will mean being able to say a dignified goodbye to loved ones in person and with those that loved and cherished them. Finally, it means that you will not be pressured by the government to take any medications or procedures that you are not comfortable with. In response to the horror of the last 2 years, we are calling for an immediate investigation into Australia's COVID-19 response. The Liberal Democrats will hold the government accountable. We will never lock you down. We will never shut down your businesses, and we will never make medical decisions on your behalf. To find out more, go to ldp.org.au.
Authorised Jay Humphries, Matt Worthy, Victoria.
Telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Michael Bolzer is no melody and optimist, but he's got a dark prognosis of where we are heading in America. Michael Bolzer is is normally an optimist. But he says inflation is going out of control, and maybe, just maybe, just maybe, just maybe, just maybe, it was on purpose.
Now, he didn't say it was on purpose, but I was wondering if it was, because these policies they've implemented are so nuts that you don't have to be an economist to see the writing on the wall. Michael, did you think about that on the break, and what say you, sir?
I did think about it, and I got to get a copy of that second jingle, too. That was even better than the first one. So
I'm
what's
improving.
Some of the evidence?
Unlike inflation, I'm improving. See, if America would just take my lead, we'd be fine. Anyway.
Perfect. So why do we think this might be on purpose? And the answer is a lot of it is on purpose. So why do I say that? President Biden, as I said in the first segment, wants to wean the country off of fossil fuels, have everybody drive electric cars, and produce their energy through renewable resources. How do you do that? If the price of fossil fuels, gas, oil, et cetera, goes up, people will look for alternatives. The reason they're not going all electric and renewable now is it costs much more money than using fossil fuels. So the president says, I don't want the petroleum industry to have a long-term future. So if I start to restrict the supply of fossil fuels now, that will drive prices up. And many in the liberal Democrats will tell you that that's a good thing, because as the price goes up, people will start to buy something else, alternative energy. So that was a on-purpose action that reduced the supply and drove prices up. And energy is really what started this inflation problem. So yes, I do think that was done on purpose. Secondly, you said, look, if President Biden has very intelligent economists around him. Couldn't they see this happening? The answer is, it was not a real concern of theirs. Normally, historically, when you set your monetary policy and when you set your fiscal policy, taxes and government spending, the goals are supposed to be, the economic goals are supposed to be price stability, that is, keep inflation low, full employment, keep unemployment low, and growth. And every president and every chair of the Federal Reserve had those goals in mind. This president has different goals in mind. He wants to cure real or perceived social injustices. It's injustice CEOs make more than everybody else. It's injustice college students borrow money and have to pay it back. It's injustice that some people can't get daycare. So he sets his policies towards social goals, not economic goals. By pursuing those social interests, it ends up having a negative impact on the economy. The other thing is,
can I chime in real quick? Let me chime in real quick on that point. Because I have to push back on it. I feel like the way he addresses social goals is eliciting division and rage, and I doesn't feel like it's genuinely trying to address social goals, because just like with the economy, the tactics that they're implementing to address social goals are leading to further division and further outrage and further breakdown of said social goals, which also doesn't seem like an accident. Because you would have to be psychologically a moron to think that these things would work. Carry on.
So when we talk about solving the social goals, the president's method for doing that is to take income away from people that have earned it through taxes and give it to people who, for whatever reason, haven't earned it. Now, if you're talking about planning division in the economy, I'm working hard, someone says. I'm making money. I'm doing very well, but the government's taking big chunks away from me, and they're giving it to people who, for whatever reason, haven't earned it. So I'm going to be a little, look, Americans, I believe, are very compassionate people. Americans need help. I think other Americans are going to be there. But if you start taking money away from people that earned it and give it to people who are physically and mentally able to earn their own money, you're right. That's going to end up leading to a lot of divisions, division. And that's what's happening in the economy today. Rather than the other view is, look, if some people don't have enough, the answer is not to take it away from people that earned it and give it to them. The answer is to give those that haven't earned enough the opportunity to earn more so they can buy their own health care. They can buy their own daycare. They can pay off the student loans. If you do that, give people opportunity to earn their own money, to pay their own bills. That's not going to lead to any division. In fact, that will tend to unify the people because everybody will say, look, we get to keep what we earn. Walter Williams, who recently passed away, used to say his idea of social justice is I keep what you earn and you I keep what I earn rather and you keep what you earn. And if we started to do that instead of taking income away from people that have earned it, a lot of this division would go away. And not only that, the economy would grow more and we would have less of an inflation problem.
Yeah, and I wasn't even talking about economic division. I was talking about more identity politics and just the obsession about that as like the 24/7 focus, you know, like, hey, here's how we're different. And really, it's just in these like, you know, non-substantive ways, in my view. I mean, people are people. I think, you know, like the Martin Luther King quote, you know, you should judge a person by the content of their soul. I think that should be the main conversation is how do we elevate our soul? How do we empower ourselves and each other? I mean, and I'm like socially, like, you know, or, you know, economically, I mean, I think healthcare is a human right. I don't think anybody should be left out of a hospital if they, well, and nowadays hospitals have a whole new weird tone to them. So it's getting really confusing, but yeah, I was talking more on other lines than even that one. So that's interesting that you bring that up as well. So, well, okay. So you agree that this seems like agenda driven. What do you think the end goal is of sinking our country and sinking the economy?
So they don't believe that they're sinking our country. They believe that if they're solving these real or perceived social injustices, it will end up helping the country. The problem is—
You think they really believe that though? Do you think that they really believe this is gonna help people? This, I mean, inflation hurts the poor most of all. Absolutely. It's not gonna hurt, you know, the rich. It's not gonna hurt the people that are even reasonably well off that much. It's, you know, it'll be a demotion for people that do pretty good. You know, they'll have to like dig a little deeper, think twice before, you know, buying that extra California roll sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, it'll be like that, yeah. But it won't be like, you know, whereas the nightmare you were describing about, you know, third world countries, it could lead to starvation. And even here in America, I mean, look at what's already happening with baby formula shortages. And that's just absurd. And, you know, you hear reports about babies going to the hospital and stuff like that over this. It's already happening. It already is here. So it's hard to believe that they think this can do any good whatsoever. I mean, I know that that's the headline that they have to give out, but it doesn't seem genuine because like it just seems so blatantly obvious that it's not going to do that.
Yeah, so you bring up a couple of good points. Who is really hurt the most by inflation? Well, as you point out, it's people on lower income, and worse yet, it's people on fixed incomes. Retirees who are living on Social Security and whatever they've saved up, they have only a certain amount of income that they can spend. So if the price of necessities ends up going up, they're going to have to eat. So they'll have to pay the higher prices, which means they're going to have less money for purchasing other things. They see the largest decline in the standard of living. The other thing that Biden wants to do, I'm not sure he's going to be able to do it, he wants to raise the corporate income tax from 21 to 28%, and he thinks wealthy people should pay more in taxes. He says, and his new press secretary said the other day, if we raise taxes on the wealthy, that will help inflation. Now, I don't know any economic theory that possibly says that. And indeed, if you raise taxes on the wealthy, it ends up hurting inflation, making it worse in the long run. Why do I say
that? Right.
There are three things people do with their income. The first thing you do is pay your taxes, Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, federal income tax. You pay your taxes. What's ever left over is disposable income. You're free to do whatever you want with it. And the two choices are you either spend it or save it. Now, if you take a look at lower income earners, they pay their taxes. All of their disposable income goes to consumption. They have very little, if anything, left over to save. For wealthy people, it's different. If somebody makes $1 million a year, let's say he pays $300,000 in taxes, he's left over with $700,000. He takes $400,000, spends it on a lavish lifestyle, and that leaves $300,000 that he can save and become his investments. If you raise taxes on the wealthy, they're still going to maintain their lifestyle, still going to spend the same amount. It will reduce the amount of saving that they have. So as a result, since they're consuming the same amount, there's no reduction in consumption and no downward pressure on prices. Making it worse, though, they've reduced their amount of savings. That reduces capital formation in the economy, especially when the federal government is $31.5 trillion in debt. So that reduces capital formation. So what happens then? Well, the government pumps up demand by overspending and keeping interest rates low. You hope that business can increase output to meet the demand and the economy would grow. In order for business to expand, there are two basic inputs they need, labor and capital. Well, we've got a labor shortage because Biden administration pays people not to work. We have a labor shortage. Now, if we have a capital shortage, business won't be able to get enough capital to expand. So if you can't expand, the only other way to react to higher demand, if you can't make more supply, the only other way to react is by raising your prices. So by overtaxing the wealthy, you reduce capital formation that leads to a capital shortage, which will tend to slow economic growth. The other thing Biden wants to do is raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28% because corporations don't pay their fair share, he told us. The problem with that is when you raise their taxes, they have less net income. They have to pay dividends to the stockholders. Otherwise, they won't be able to raise any capital. So they pay the dividends. What's ever left over is retained earnings, which again goes to create capital for expansion. So raising corporate income taxes will reduce retained earnings and reduce capital formation even more. And again, with less capital, business can expand to meet the high demand, and that will lead to higher prices. So overtaxing the wealthy, even Jeff Bezos, you know, owns the Washington Post, and he's generally very liberal in his views. Even he says, he got in this back and forth with Biden in the last week or two. He said, look, raising taxes on the wealthy is not going to reduce inflation. And he's right for just the reasons that I gave.
So you're basically saying the worst part of inflation is that rich people won't be able to buy as many NFTs. That's what you're saying.
No,
I'm joking. I'm just made a dumb joke. Listen, we'll be right back after these words with Michael Bulzer on TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
How will current decisions in the U.S. Congress affect the outcome of the midterm elections? Consider that as Americans struggle in the current economic crisis, most members of the US Congress appear to be oblivious and have voted in favor of a $40 billion so-called security assistance package for Ukraine. Across the entire Congress, all Democrats voted in lockstep with the Biden administration. Most Republicans joined in, 149 in the House and 37 in the Senate. But 57 House Republicans dissented, along with 11 Republican senators. This Republican minority will be cheered by many Americans who are sick of participating in foreign wars, particularly one that risks nuclear war with Russia. So far, the primary election results indicate that opposition to US involvement in the Ukrainian conflict is a winning strategy, but most in the Congress have aligned with the military-industrial complex. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Papa, when we go see the twins, can we go down to the lake?
Only if Kate's with you, or Mum and I are there too. What are you sighing about?
I can swim.
I know you can. You're a very good swimmer. But are you forgetting the five?
How can I forget the five? You make me say it 10 times a day.
Slight exaggeration.
Fence the pool, shut the gate, teach your kids to swim, it's great. Supervise, watch your mate, and learn how to resuscitate.
Supervise, Harper, supervise. I'm Laurie Lawrence. Kids alive.
Do the five.
Where progress is influenced by revolution and evolution. This is today's News Talk Radio.
TNT.
TNT.
And we're back with Michael Bolzer talking about inflation and the dumpster fire that is our current economy. You were talking about microchip shortage. I'm more worried about a potato chip shortage. The food shortages are really spooky because when people are hungry, they're going to go crazy and crime sprees are up. And, you know, you can hardly blame people for going ballistic in that realm if they're hungry and they see the writing on the wall. Do you think this is just a way to bring in martial law and just create total chaos so the government can implement total control over its population?
Well, I certainly hope not. You know, it's hard to tell what their motives are. I'm hoping it's not that sinister, but certainly it's a view you can take. You know, Joseph, I'm sorry.
No, but I just wanted to say this real quick, and I want you to say what you're about to say. But honestly, man, I know it makes me maybe sound like a little bit like a conspiracy theorist or whatever that even means anymore. Somebody that thinks, you know, it's the only thing that takes away the cognitive dissonance. When you put all the pieces together, the only explanation that makes my brain go, no cognitive dissonance, is a sinister agenda, because it is so sinister what is happening. You know, so anyway, but go ahead. What were you about to say?
Yeah. I hope that's not completely right. I can see you drawing those conclusions, but I really hope that that's not the intent of the Biden administration. But as I said,
I'm with you there. I hope so, too.
It certainly can be. So beginning of the show, you asked me to talk about inflation, and then you said, what can people do about it? I said, well, I can talk about inflation. What to do about it's a little bit harder. So what can
We're on the same page, Michael, because that is exact. We got 14 minutes left in the interview, and I was going to round it out with maybe to get into some optimism in what we could do about it. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Okay. So the immediate action that consumers can take is when prices start to go up, don't pay them. Start to look for some alternative or cut back. Now, why haven't consumers done that so far? The government has given everybody all this free money in the last 2 years. Most of it ended up being saved by the average household. So when prices go up a lot, people complain about it, but they have the money to pay for it, and that allows inflation to continue. Consumers are getting into an inflation psychology instead of a normal consumer psychology. What do I mean by that? Prior to inflation, my wife likes to drink a certain kind of red wine. The place I go to buy it, I look for a nice $10 bottle of wine. I happen to find one. So I've been paying $10 for it. One day I go in and it costs $11 a bottle. Now, I should have cut back on how much I bought. I don't know how much my wife would take that, but I should have cut back on what I bought or looked for an alternative, but I just didn't do that. I went ahead and paid it. Under normal times, if you see a 10% price increase between the last time you bought something and when you're buying it now, the normal reaction is, wait a minute, I'm not going to pay this. I'm going to look around for something else. Maybe I can use a little less of the product. That's a normal behavior. Once you get into this inflation psychology, once you see the price go up, people start to think, I better buy it now before the price gets higher tomorrow. Once you get into that psychology, prices are going to definitely be higher tomorrow. So in the short term, what you can do is try to cut back on those things where prices are going up. And I know people are going to say, well, it's necessity. I have to drive my car. I have to eat. What do you want me to do?
I was just about to say that. With gas, it's like gas is the most brutal one. I'm in Arizona. I just moved here. I was a New Yorker forever, where a car doesn't matter. Here in Arizona, literally everything is 20 minutes away. That's one of the only downsides so far. I love it here. Even the heat is cool with me. And I know I haven't gotten to the crazy heat yet, but still, the point is everything is 20 minutes away. I go through at least $100 worth of gas a week, at least. I'm not joking. It's crazy. So I love what you're saying, and I think that's a good tactic, but how do you deal when you need to go from point A to point B and the gas prices are what they are?
So you have some of the driving you do is mandatory. I've got to get to work. I've got to do this. Some of the driving you do is discretionary. So if you can cut back on that, or you know, if you go food shopping twice a week, try to go once a week, because you have to drive 20 minutes to get there. Try to go once a week and buy more at that one time rather than two times. If you can carpool with somebody, try to do something like that. And I know that's not an easy answer either. But look, if gasoline got up to $10 a gallon, I don't ever think that'll happen, I don't think. If it got up to $10 a gallon, I guarantee you would find ways to save on gas, because you wouldn't be able to pay for it. And even if you could,
I'm going to get a motorcycle. I'm actually looking at motorcycles. I've never been a motorcycle guy at all. I'm not like Mr. Fonzie cool guy or anything. But honestly, it's like that's my solution. I'm looking at motorcycles just so I can get around.
So if we start looking at those solutions now, rather than waiting until the price gets too high, that will help keep the price down. Other than that, the only other way is to do it at the ballot box. Elect people that say, we're not going to spend all this money that we don't have. We're not going to push the social agenda over economic goals. We're going to try to get the economy back to where it should be. And frankly, these people will say it's much easier to solve social problems when the economy is doing extremely well. It's difficult to solve these social problems when unemployment goes up and inflation is reducing purchasing power of consumers. So elect people that are not driven by a social agenda, but are rather driven by a sound economic agenda based on the principles that made the U.S. great. Now, let me take a minute on that one. So the U.S. went from the birth of a nation to the largest, most prosperous economy in the world in about 150 years. Other countries were hundreds, in some cases, thousands of years older. How did we do that? In my view, there were four basic principles. One, we encouraged individual freedom. As long as you didn't infringe upon anybody else's rights, you can pretty much do what you wanted to do. Secondly, we encouraged individual responsibility. You're mentally and physically able to take care of yourself. Everybody took care of themselves. Thirdly, we had low rates of taxation. You know, prior to 1913, I think we didn't have an income tax. Prior to 1935, we didn't have a Social Security tax. Prior to 1965, we didn't have a Medicare tax. So we had low rates of taxation. So when people took chances and earned something, you knew you were going to get to keep most of what you earned. And fourthly, we had a limited role for government. There's certain public goods government has to supply, defense of the country, leadership, a legal system, et cetera. But beyond that, government stayed out of the way. So individual freedom, individual responsibility, low rates of taxation, and a limited role for government are really what made the U.S. great, a great economic power. So if you elect people that follow those basic principles, we'll get back to where we were before, where we had good economic growth, extremely low inflation, and more importantly, we had opportunity for everyone. Even some of the minorities that don't feel they're getting the same opportunity, there was opportunity for everyone. Unemployment hit an historic low of 3.5%. And the unemployment rates in the Hispanic community, the Asian community, the African-American community, those unemployment rates were very low. So now people said, you know, I can earn enough money to buy my own things. I don't need the government to do this. We've now starting to transfer in. The government's going to take care of you. Don't worry. The government will pay your college debt off for you. The government will pay for health insurance for you if you can't afford it. And I would agree with you. I'd like to see every American have health care, health insurance, and proper health care. How we get there, I'm going to differ much from what the Democratic position is. But I agree that that should be a necessity for everyone. So once everybody is working and once they have opportunities for advancement and opportunities to contribute more to the economy, because you're paid according to the value in theory, you're paid according to the value of your contribution. So if we give people opportunities to contribute more, they're going to get paid more, and then they can buy their own health care and they can buy all the things that they need rather than relying on government. The whole Biden administration is opposite to all four of those principles.
Oh, yeah, I that's what I'm saying. It's just it has to be an agenda of, to create chaos and fear, because that's exactly where it's heading, and crime and every, you could just go down a list, and you know they're firing police officers in New York because they refuse a mandate for a shot that is, shall we say, a little problematic. You know what I mean? Like, dude, it's questionable, like, while crime is what? Huh?
I said it's even questionable whether these vaccines are working as well as they think, and there are some very negative side effects. Dude,
it's beyond questionable at this point. But I want to ask you another question. I don't want to go down that whole rabbit hole, but I did bring it up. But so on top, and considering everything you've just illustrated over the course of this hour, what's your take on $40 billion to Ukraine?
Americans are very compassionate people, and we like to see democracy thrive. Ukraine didn't exactly have a democracy, but it's close. I think we...
Is it really close? I mean, haven't they been killing off anybody who's like, you know, any political opponents and all this other, I don't really know everything going on over there, but the Nazi stuff over there and everything like that, it seems a bit odd. But I'm just talking more on an economical level, you know, in lieu of all of our problems over here, do you think it's sound to give them $40 billion right now?
And keep in mind, that's $40 billion that the government does not have. So they're going to have to borrow.
They're going to print the money.
Or sell bonds to finance it. So we're looking at what our foreign policy is. The thing is, we didn't have to do this. You remember when Biden pulled out of Afghanistan, he left behind $85 billion worth of military equipment. Had he taken
was that
an out
accident?
Of there,
do you think that was an accident?
it looks to me, oops, with all due respect, sheer stupidity. Why would he send $85 billion over there?
You don't accidentally leave $85 billion worth of weapons behind. That's not an accident.
I don't know why they did that. Certainly doesn't make
because any now sense the weapon manufacturers can make a lot more money to make more weapons. And maybe
wasn't the reason, but it seems
a stretch to think that was an oops, aw shucks, we didn't see that coming. I mean, a grade schooler could have seen that coming. But go ahead with the $40 billion in Ukraine.
So had we done that, we wouldn't have to spend any more to give weapons to Ukraine. When I looked at what's in that $40 billion, it's not all aid to Ukraine or some other things in there. That's why Rand Paul refused to even let the vote go to the floor, because he said, look, well, you can get by with far less than $40 billion, probably something in the $25, $30 billion range, which is still too much since we don't have the money. But $40 billion, I think most people agree, was way too much to spend at a time when our deficit is ballooning and we're, we simply don't have the money. The Federal Reserve can't print any more money now, because that will lead to more inflation. In fact, what they're doing, They're selling some of the bonds that they purchased from the federal government last year. And why do they do that? So when you purchase bonds, you inject money into the system.
Got about 1 minute, Michael.
Increase the money supply. When they sell their bonds, they're going to pull money out of the system, and that'll reduce the money supply and reduce inflation. So was $40 billion the right number? I think it was way too high. We could have done something a lot less and kept everybody happy.
Well, Michael Balzer, it's been great talking to you. Really informative, and I learned a lot, so I really appreciate it. And tell people how to get in touch with you in 30 seconds.
So you can follow my Twitter account, at mbusler, that's M-B-U-S-L-E-R. And if you have a Facebook page, search for Funding Democracy. Funding Democracy. I post every one of the columns I write for Newsmax and Town Hall and some of the other places. And if anybody wanted to follow me, I'd be real happy.
All right, Michael Balzer, we'll see you soon. And hopefully you have an incredible weekend, sir. Keep listening, everybody. You're listening to TNT Radio.